Off Message is brought to you by The Great Courses Plus, engaging video lectures presented by top university professors on a variety of topics. It's the perfect way to learn for the pure pleasure of it. With The Great Courses Plus, you'll have unlimited access to a wealth of knowledge, watch lectures from any device on your own schedule. Sign up today and get your first month free. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. Hey, everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast. We're doing this thing on Wednesday because I just got back from the UK. I was on a couple of panels at the Edinburgh Politics Festival, which was actually held in the Scottish Parliament. It was a lot of fun. Most of my time, I should tell you, was spent reassuring very nervous Scotsmen and Scotswomen about Donald Trump. Everywhere I went where they found out what I did, people were coming up to me pretty much on bended knee, begging me to tell them that Donald Trump was never, ever going to be president. I could not provide them with that reassurance, though. Back home in America, Trump was seemingly doing everything he could to ensure that result was actually going to happen. So this was kind of a working vacation. But one of the things that I really wanted to do, and I wanted to do for a number of years, was to talk with Tony Blair, the former prime minister of Great Britain, and someone who I always viewed as Bill Clinton's alter ego. Blair and Clinton have gone in totally opposite directions. Tony Blair's reputation is unbelievably bad. I did an informal poll of cabbies in London. I took about 12 cab rides, and each cabbie I asked them what they thought of Tony Blair, and eight of the cabbies said that they hated him. And that seems to comport with what his public relations standing is right now. And it's largely on the back of one thing, and that is supporting George W. Bush all the way on the Iraq invasion. To some extent, Blair has fallen even further than W. On this. And he's particularly fallen because the Labour Party that he represented as New Labour during his tenure from 1997 to 2007, it was all about renouncing the far-left, pro-union, socialist underpinnings of the British Labour Party. And, of course, that script has flipped. Jeremy Corbyn got elected as head of Labour, very much a figure parallel to Bernie Sanders. And unlike the Clintons, particularly Hillary Clinton, you know, Blair hasn't really adjusted. He hasn't moved from being a third-way centrist, proud centrist, to being, as Hillary Clinton positions herself, as a progressive. So we got Blair kind of at the last minute. Bridget gave me a recorder. We didn't have mics, so I backed up the recording on the iPhone. We were sitting in Blair's office in Grosvenor Square in a conference room that was right on the square. So you can hear in the background all the lorries and cabs roaring by. I think it kind of adds to the ambiance as I was sitting across from Tony Blair. So the sound quality might be a little less than we wanted. But in general, I think I clearly have a promising career in audio engineering ahead of us, as you can tell. One thing about Blair personally, I always think of him from Michael Sheen. I guess that's the name of the actor in The Queen. I mean, I guess Sheen has played Blair in a couple of these other movies as being kind of this incredibly boyish, almost puppy dog-like dude. And Blair, when he first came into 10 Downing, had the nickname Bambi because he had that kind of wide-eyed doe look on his face. The man has changed a lot. I was really struck. He's still very handsome. He shows up to this conference room, which is full of this wonderful artwork, including what looked like a Cezanne. I didn't get close enough to look at it. And he's carrying his own coffee cup, and he's wearing what appears to be a 100-pound shirt. And he looked like Tony Blair, except when you got up really close to him, and he now is a 63-year-old man. He has inhabited every one of those 63 years. I think the Iraq experience, the Chilcot Commission, which just came out, which ruled that he had performed badly in the run-up to the Iraq War, this notion that people want to bring him up on war crimes, has put him in a very defensive set. And he was much different than I had anticipated, much more sober. And that really reflects the nature of this conversation. He was very, I thought, not only self-effacing, but kind of self-scouring. And he says, frankly, at the top of the broadcast, the podcast, that he wonders if his day is done, if his form of centrism is just a thing in the dustbin of history. I think that's a fascinating thing, particularly in light of the fact that he explicitly says that he talks to Bill and Hillary Clinton, and they share his philosophy. And now for our usual business, please follow us on iTunes and rate us. We've got, Bridget tells me we've got over 200 ratings, and they are very, very good, which means that 195 paid people and members of my family have done the job that they're supposed to do. Ha, 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 ha. Gotten some complaints recently. I always love complaints, as you guys know. During the John Dickerson interview we did a couple of weeks ago, I got some emails saying that I interrupted him too much and that I was talking too much about myself. And my response to those people is, get your own damn podcast. Not really. I'll try to hold it back. With Blair, it was easy because he did a lot of the talking. And also, I think people have really very, this one I take very, very seriously. We have not had enough women on. We just have not had enough women. I think part of that, if I'm going to give myself an excuse, has to do with the fact that the Republican field was more dominated by both male candidates and male staff. But it's really not an excuse, and we're going to go out of our way to get the very many interesting and informative female guests on that we can. We're going to work on that pretty assiduously. So without any further ado, here is Tony Blair. Every day I work so hard, bringing home my heart and pain. Try to love you, baby, but you push me away. So I guess the first thing I want to ask you is, how closely have you been following the American election?
Closely. Yeah. You if you're interested in politics and you're not following it, then it would be a little bizarre. So, yeah, of course.
What do you think is so interesting about it?
I think many of the issues in the American campaign mirror those happening in the rest of politics, certainly in the UK and the rest of Europe right now. Elements to do with the rise of populism. Strong movements, insurgent movements of left and right, the center feeling under attack and on the defensive, and many of the same issues, actually. So if you take issues like student debt, for example, it's an issue in the American campaign, it's an issue in the British campaign. Foreign policy, how far do you get engaged, how far do you not? Trade, globalization, yep, these are the questions of our time. And what always happens, in my experience, is that people always think American politics is very different, but usually it is a predictor of what happens in the politics elsewhere.
So you see it as a leading indicator as opposed to a lagging indicator?
Yes, I do, usually.
So what does Donald Trump tell you about the tsunami that's about in the UK or Europe?
Well, the Trump phenomenon in the US is mirrored completely by the Brexit phenomenon in the UK. It's very similar forces. And what is interesting to me is there are two different groups that come together who don't really agree with each other, but who come together in unity against, if you like, what is perceived as the status quo, or and certainly what is a more center-right or center-left type of politics. So those two groups would be what I would call, in our terms, you know, looking at the Brexit case, what I would call the kind of ultra-Thatcherites, who see Brexit as the first step into Britain becoming a sort of free market, free trading, offshore hub. And those who are actually anti-globalization, anti-free trade, who believe that they've been left behind by the forces of globalization and want to protest against it. But those two people come together in opposition to centre-right and centre-left. And that is what is interesting about it, because it's a very strong protest force.
How much of this is issue-based? I mean, we tend to, you know, you're a hyper-rationalist, you're a pragmatist. How much of this is really issue-based, and how much of this do you think is emotive and reactive to an overall lack of trust in institutions?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, one of the things that I've been doing over the past few years is reevaluating my own powers of political analysis. You know, because there were times when I was growing up in politics and when I was prime minister, when I had complete confidence in my own ability just as a professional to predict the course of politics. And, you know, the last few years have caused me to question, in particular, to focus on the question you've just put. You know, to what degree is this driven by a genuine change in the way the world's working? And to what degree is it a product of the way politics works today, of people's dissatisfaction with institutions, of the revolutionary impact of social media, for example? Because I think social media is a revolutionary phenomenon all in itself.
Insofar as it accelerates things?
What it does is it allows insurgent movements that are movements of protest to arise at scale and with speed in a way that was impossible when I was starting out in politics or even when I was prime minister.
Give me an example of an issue that you would have dealt with, that you were able to deal with because you had more fullness of time as prime minister, that you would probably not have the time to deal with now. What would have stopped you? What issue would you have been stopped on?
I think I would have found the reforms that we did. We did major reforms in education and healthcare. I would have found them harder to do. I mean, I would still have tried to do them, by the way, because one thing I'm not sure of, and is a very open question, is whether the type of politics that I represent really has had its day or not. Now, I obviously believe passionately it hasn't, that it's still the answer and not the problem. And, you know, the evidence points both ways. I mean,
you really aren't sure. I mean, you aren't sure if your era is over.
I think that's the question.
Right.
I believe it isn't. But, you know, when you take Brexit or you take Trump, Sanders in the US, or you take Jeremy Corbyn becoming leader of the Labour Party,
right.
Classic.
Right.
You've got to say, well, if you told me in 2007 that was likely, I would have said, no, that's not likely at all. And I would have said that with a fair degree of confidence. So, you know, you have to, one of the most important things in politics is you've got to keep your mind infinitely curious and alive to what is happening differently. On the other hand, you've also got to say that the British general election last year was won by David Cameron from the centre-right, that Renzi has probably been the most, or one of the most successful politicians in recent times as an avowedly centrist leader of the left in Italy. You see exactly the same strains within the French Socialist Party today. And, you know, after all, Hillary Clinton is the Democrat nominee. And, you know, at least if the polls are correct, has a fair chance of winning. So, you know, this is not a decided argument at all. And that's why I say I am reevaluating and rethinking, but I'm not persuaded that the politics of the centre is wrong. On the contrary, I still think it's the most important. And I think that ultimately what is happening is that you are getting a whole series of issues that really grew up in the later part of the 20th century that are now going to provide probably a fairly profound political realignment at some point.
And we're talking about income inequality, free trade. What other issues do you think?
Well, I think the driving force of globalization, for sure, because let's be clear, one of the paradoxes of globalization is that in the developing world, we've seen massive reductions in poverty. I mean, we forget this. If you look at the Millennium Development Goals that were set out by the UN in the year 2000, which I was part of formulating, I mean, okay, they've not all been met, but many of them have been substantially met.
But what you have is...
In the developed world,
right.
You've then got this flattening of income.
Right.
But the question is, what is the right way to deal with this? Now, my view is the center and center right and center left need to rediscover what I call their muscularity. In other words, we have become guardians of the status quo in an area where people want change. But wanting change is what everyone says. The question is, what type of change? What's the right change to produce a different outcome for the people left behind by globalization?
Well, in the American election, Hillary Clinton has, she's become very close to Joseph Stiglitz, who's one of the individuals, kind of an avatar of that movement. And she has clearly been moved to the left by Bernie Sanders. Not clear how durable that movement will be. Do you think she has been sufficiently muscular? And if you were to, obviously, we had a president come over here prior to the Brexit vote and weigh in on things. So I'm certain that you're not eager to dive into the minutiae of American politics. Yeah. But in general, I mean, what are sort of the issues, if you're looking at the American election, that could be most appealing for Hillary Clinton to pitch to voters?
Well, I think it is having answers and not simply anger, and providing solutions that people believe will change their lives in a radical way, but do it in a way that's sensible. So now that is a lot harder for her to do. So if someone comes along and says, I'm going to make university free, you could exactly the same argument going on the left in the Democrats and the left over here. That's great. Who wouldn't want that? But the fact is, it's going to be paid for. And what is obviously unfair is that the half of the population that doesn't go to university, that's offer on lower incomes, pays more taxes in order to send other people to university without them, contributing. So if you analyze the plan that Hillary Clinton has put forward for helping...
The one in combination, we should say, it was it was negotiated with Bernie Sanders at the end of the...
That's, by the way, you've got to respond to the strong feelings people have, but that is what I would say is a serious plan to deal with the problem. But it won't get you the same round of applause as a plan that says, I'm going to cancel all your debt and give it to you for free.
So aren't we in the States anyway, and you talked about us being a leading indicator, it seems to me that with Sanders' role in the Clinton campaign, and by the way, it's not clear at all the extent to which that will be durable, we are entering a little bit of a coalition government in the United States. We have the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party. Clinton can't afford to ignore her left any longer. I mean, there have been pieces out recently talking about how she's going to turn her back on this. I don't think, if she wants congressional support for anything, that she can afford to do that. She will lose her base.
Yeah, but I think people confuse two separate things here. One is, it would be a huge mistake to turn your back on the issues, because these are real issues that people have.
Right.
And if you've got communities that feel they've been left behind, if you've got, as you do in Britain at the moment, you have communities that believe they're being changed by immigration, that they don't have job opportunities, that they're disregarded, and that they've got no stake in a future which embraces globalization. You've got to address that issue. So you've got to distinguish between addressing the issue and then what is the right policy to make a difference and not make a point. Because a lot of the politics that is going on left and right at the moment is more about a protest, which we should respond to. It's not often about a policy. And that's why what you get is this strange coalition of different views of what the future should be coming together in alliance to protest against the status quo. But if you actually, and this is classically true on Brexit, if you were to say to those people, right, you're now in government, what are you going to do? Now, we're going to face some really tough choices on Brexit coming down the track at us. And there will be a certain point at which the only future that would work economically outside of Brexit is going to be far to the right of anything that the mainstream of the British public would actually vote for.
Were you personally surprised that Boris stood aside and didn't stand for PM or leader of the party?
I mean, I assume that was to do with the internal machinations of how the Tory factions were playing out with each other. So I don't know that there was any significance beyond that. But I don't, I'm not, to be frank, I don't know more than you know.
without telling tales out of school, you've communicated with the Clintons. You've been very close to Bill Clinton over the years. Saw some very amusing transcripts of conversations and some phony ones, which were equally as amusing.
I'm trying to spell the difference for me.
Yeah, that's right. Have you talked with them over the, and not necessarily in the context of this particular year, but have you discussed some of the issues that you just discussed with me with any of the Clintons?
Yeah, I mean, they're thinking about it the whole time. I mean, there's no two smarter people in politics, and they, you know, of course, this is the nub of the issue. How do you respond to what are genuine anxieties and fears, but come up with a response that has real integrity? And that, and real integrity means an answer. It doesn't mean riding the anger. And this is very difficult to do. But I still think there is a residual desire amongst the majority of the public to be given a proper solution. You know, this is why I as I said to you, I'm reevaluating the whole time, but I haven't come to the conclusion that centrist politics is wrong or dead. On the contrary, I think it's very much alive, but it needs to be given a renewal, a revival, and a muscularity, which it presently lacks.
And when you talk about immigration, immigration is a huge driver. Donald Trump has backed off, apparently in private, some of his more extreme statements. We're seeing a new Trump this past week. To what does it say about American politics? And again, to refer back to your discussion of America as being a leading indicator, why do you think Trump has been so successful in harnessing the immigration issue in terms of his own candidacy?
For the same reason that politicians are successful everywhere in Europe. I mean, immigration was probably the driving thing behind Brexit. Now, again, what the center ground has got to do is to respond to people's genuine concerns and fears.
What are the genuine? Differentiate for me, please.
Right.
The genuine versus the airside.
So what I always say to people is, when you deal with immigration, and I fought my last general election campaign on immigration.
Right.
Conservatives made it the centerpiece of their campaign. And what I always say to people is, what you require are rules and not prejudices. Right. In other words, there are people who are anxious about immigration for reasons that are perfectly sensible. They think it's uncontrolled. They think it's therefore arbitrary in its consequences, and there are some communities affected much more deeply than others.
Right. Right?
That is a perfectly legitimate set of fears. And if you end up sort of castigating those people for having those fears, you'll land up in completely the wrong place politically.
Right.
And then there are those people who basically don't like those who are different. Okay. Now, that is a prejudice. And it's a prejudice that's dangerous, because in the world today, the world works through connectivity. It works through going across the boundaries of faith and culture and race and a nation. So what does that mean? It means two things. One, that you need to have proper controls in place on immigration that have some genuine chance of being implemented and seem to people to be fair. And I mean to the broad, more reasonable middle ground. And the second thing you need to do is, you need to, and I think America does this quite well, in fact, you need to say as a society, we support diversity, but there's also a common space. Right? So there's a space where people pursue their own faith, their own culture, and that's great. But there's also a space that we hold in common. So what that means in the politics over this side of the water, for example, is if you come here as an immigrant, you play by the rules that we have, right? You support democracy, you support freedom, you support the rule of law, you support equal rights for women and men. You know, you don't say, well, my culture, my background allows me to depart from that common space. So I think there are these two fears that people have. One, that it's uncontrolled, and two, that people come in who don't share the values and aren't prepared to share the values that in fact unite the country.
Right.
So, in my view, if you want to handle the immigration issue and handle it in a sensitive and sensible way, because actually immigration is good for a country, it brings fresh energy.
It lowers the age of the workforce.
Yeah. Lowers the age of the workforce.
Yep.
All the evidence here, for example, in Britain, is that migrants, particularly from the rest of Europe, who come here contribute far more in taxes. They do.
But that's not the political hot call. And you mentioned those two words, prejudice and dangerous. Do you think, and I know you don't want to necessarily weigh in on this, but do you view the phenomenon of Trump, particularly in his discussion of immigration, as being prejudiced, as being dangerous?
Well, I mean, I don't want to get into commenting on your election, but the moment you stigmatize a whole group of people for example, Muslims, then obviously you make the decent law-abiding Muslims feel as if they're under threat in some way, or that their legitimacy as members of citizens of society brought into question. It's exactly the same issues you have here. What I'm really more interested in doing, because I think in a way that's kind of obvious, right. And you can see, look, in Austria, you've got a, right today, you've got a far right candidate who may become the president. He's in a close run race.
Right. And the Le Pen.
In France, Le Pen, if she gets through to the second round, then that is that's a fundamental change in the politics of France. So this is the same everywhere. What is, again, more, because it's clear that some of these politicians are playing to prejudice. The question for us, though, is how do we meet people's genuine concerns whilst differentiating ourselves from that prejudice?
Do you think this is of a moment, or do you think this is a snowball? Do you think we are at a moment where things have caught on fire, or do you think we are dealing with an entirely change? I guess it gets to the general point that you were making earlier. I mean, but if you were to sort of, where does your gut tell you we're at?
I think we are dealing with what is essentially the inevitable political challenges of globalization. In other words, as the world transforms, moves closer together, jobs are displaced, the world of work completely changes the way we live, the way we think. As that revolution goes on around us, it is going to pose political challenges, of which immigration is one very obvious one, which are going to be extremely difficult to deal with. But it's like it's like free trade. You know, in the end, if we go protectionist, we'll make a mistake. So this is why, you know, I said for about 10 years, I think the single most important political distinction today is actually between open-minded versus closed-minded. And that's why I think this crosses the boundaries of traditional center-right and center-left have much more in common with each other right now than the right does with the center-right and the left does with the center-left.
I think you're seeing that, I think, in some of the alliances that Clinton is forming.
Hey, remember when I said I was going to try not to interrupt anybody? Well, I'm interrupting Tony Blair, but it's for a good reason. It is to talk about The Great Courses Plus. Look, this political season, you've heard all the speeches, or at least I have. You've seen the news. Now we want you to learn the history behind it all, and here's the way. Sign up for The Great Courses Plus. You'll get unlimited access to engaging video lectures on history, politics, economics, and so many other subjects that will explain how we got to this crazy moment, presented by award-winning professors and experts. So sign up for The Great Courses Plus now, and you'll get a free month of unlimited access to all the courses, including, for instance, The Skeptic's Guide to American History. Start your free month now by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. Now, back to Tony Blair.
I want to get a little bit of a lightning round here since I don't have too much more time. First of all, just back to that one point. Do you think Trump's success is emboldening the right in Europe? Do you think they're looking at what's going on in the United States and thinking, we're part of a larger movement? We're even seeing it in the United States.
Yes, to a degree. Because it gives people a sense that, you know, what they feel is also being felt elsewhere.
Are you personally frightened by this?
Look, I always say to people when they ask me about American politics, it's for you guys to decide who you elect. But obviously, I'm a centrist. I'm an avowed centrist, and I believe it. Centrism is often, it's almost the wrong word to use, because it's often seen as sort of splitting the difference between right and left. Or, you know, we got into this situation where people talk about triangulation. My policies have never been about triangulation, and neither really is Bill Clinton's. It's not, it's about applying your values to the future in an practical and unblinkered way. And that is an ideological view that is every bit as strong as views from the left or from the right.
Well, it's fundamentally the way people govern. I mean, Barack Obama came as hope and change, and progressives were somewhat disappointed. He's been a center-left president. He's not a leftist president
by any stretch of the imagination.
I just want to drag you back into the minefield for one more second.
If you want me to get it.
No, and that'll be it. And I'll hit you on your own stuff, which is, you know, which will be more annoying to you. So in terms of the, when you look at, you knew, obviously you governed very closely with Bill Clinton. You had a great relationship with him, and you've, your family has had a relationship with Hillary Clinton. How do you differentiate them in terms of sort of their governing philosophy and in terms of their capacities as politicians, having observed them for as long as you have?
Well, obviously, I work very closely with President Clinton, but I also worked very closely with Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State, because I was because I was handling parts of the Middle East peace process at that time, and you know, I've got a huge regard for her. I mean, I think she is a an outstandingly capable and decent person. You know, I worked with her really very closely over that on a very tricky issue, where the politics was extremely delicate and where, you know, there were many different and contradictory currents.
You're talking about Libya?
No, I'm talking about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. But also we talked about the wider the wider Middle East. And, you know, I found her both extremely good to work with and also someone you could completely rely on.
When you talked about muscularity, is it your sense, because I wrote stories at the time that she along with Susan Rice was counseling Obama to take a more active role in Libya. Do you think that she will, use the term muscular before, have a more muscular foreign policy, a little less apprehensive about intervention than Obama?
Well, I think the circumstances of intervention are just completely different and will become even more different. The big change between the time that I was in government and today, and you can see actually President Obama has responded to this himself, the big change is that we have allies in the Middle East region today who are prepared to work with us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, therefore your intervention is not the same as it was. So for example, when we're taking the fight to ISIS, we're working in alliance with other countries in a way that wouldn't really have been possible. When I was Prime Minister, the Arab Spring has changed everything about the Middle East, and it is altering the whole politics of the Middle East in a very profound way that I don't think we quite understand in the West yet. And as well as all the turmoil, it's offering enormous opportunities. So she doesn't, you know, she is going to be in a position, if she becomes president, where there are real alliances to be struck that mean that America doesn't, you don't have to keep looking at the future foreign policy in terms simply of the past. And my view always is that we should learn the lessons both of the last sort of 15 years of policy making, and it is possible to get to a foreign policy that is engaged and active without going back to where we were in the post 9/11 world.
Do you think she'd be more likely to opt for intervention in any, because I think the defining characteristic of the Obama foreign policy has been non-intervention. I mean, that's what he was elected on in 2008. I covered him, and I covered him in the White House. And I think if you're going to look for a philosophical leitmotif for his foreign policy, it would be this tremendous reluctance to commit ground troops. We saw that with the Red Line.
I mean, I think, you know, obviously as a result of the experience of the past, and you know, I went through Afghanistan and Iraq and so on, there's going to be a huge reluctance to make that type of commitment, but it's not necessary to make that type of commitment because, as I say, the world has changed. And, you know, you can see in how President Obama has stepped up his commitment in both Syria and Iraq, and by the way, to great effect. I mean, without that American commitment, ISIS would not have lost the territory that it's lost. Right now in Libya as well. You know, this is, so I think it's possible for these issues to be, you know, we shouldn't be the prisoner of the past in dealing with these issues for the future.
In terms of, I want to talk about, we just had this extraordinary press conference you gave after the Chilcot report. I don't want to talk about the specifics of that. I want to talk about the larger impact on the politics of both in the UK and the United States. It's my general feeling, it's more than my feeling, that the Iraq experience and the financial crisis of 2008 were tectonic in terms of people's trust in institutions. I just think they've had profound impacts, particularly in the Republican Party in the United States. To what extent You talked personally about your decision. To what extent do you think that Iraq experience has changed the politics in the UK and the US in terms of trust?
I think it's, you can debate trust, but the thing that is most important about it is that it's shown people that if you intervene in these circumstances, where radical Islamism is going to be a factor, it's going to be very, very tough. And you can talk about Iraq, but actually people learned the same lesson from Afghanistan. You see, even if you take the issues...
The good war versus the bad war thing,
yeah, but
as
even,
Obama would say.
Right, but even if you look at Afghanistan, if you look at the commitment and the loss of troops and the difficulty and where we are even today with the Taliban trying to find a way back, what these interventions show you is how difficult it is. On the other hand, what I would say is what Libya and Syria show you is that other options are also difficult. So this is why ultimately I think there is a possibility, I don't say it's more than that, that we will come to a view of foreign policy going forward that learns from the past but doesn't
But you're talking about operating on the policy level. I'm talking about operating on the political level internally, and obviously you need political consensus to do anything in terms of intervention. So my question is, you know, the issue of the faulty or false intelligence that was a huge issue in bringing George W. Bush down had a great deal to do with your difficulties. To what extent is it important in terms of the presentation of evidence to people, the conversation, being on the level with them? I mean, talk about that in terms of the reestablishment
right, so,
of
So what I'm really saying to you is, of course that's important, yeah. But as the debate over Syria shows, when there really wasn't any, there was no dispute about the evidence,
right.
You're still going to get an enormous reluctance. And that reluctance is not really derived from the trust issue. It's derived from the difficulty issue.
Right, okay.
Okay? And, you know, what you know now about any of these situations, sometimes people is that it's going to be really difficult.
Right.
So sometimes people say to me, well, what was the difference between Kosovo, which was a successful intervention, and Iraq and Afghanistan that have been so difficult? And the answer is perfectly simple. In Kosovo, you had, after the removal of the Milosevic regime, you had a process of political and economic reconstruction that took its path without the intervention of terrorism. If you had the intervention of terrorism, by the way, it would have been extremely difficult there.
Right.
But we didn't,
right.
Fortunately. The difference, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan, or by the way, Libya or Syria, is the politics, and you can see that in Yemen too, by the way, the politics becomes immensely complicated by the presence of this extremism.
Right.
And whether it's extremism promoted by Iranian-backed militia on the one side or various varieties of Sunni extremism on the other, like ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra or any of these, or Al-Qaeda, once you're in that situation, it's going to be tough. And that's why the real issue going forward is, to what degree are you prepared to be engaged? And what I say to people is, we're going to have to be engaged. I mean, us in Europe, for example, we have got a direct interest in what happens in Syria today. Why have we got this huge problem?
Right, no, that's right. the source of the infection to some extent.
Yeah, so when you... But the difference between now and dealing with it back when I was in office is, because you've got this revolution going on in the Middle East following the Arab Spring, you actually have the opportunity to form alliances with people, which mean that you can deal with this issue in a different way. It's still going to be really difficult.
But I would argue that I'm sitting across from one of the most brilliant politicians of the 20th and 21st centuries, somebody who was able to pull together coalitions in a way that no one had done before. And you're not looking at what's going on domestically in terms of I think the trust issue is so fundamental in terms of being able to muster consensuses for the policies that you're articulating. I think such a tremendous... I deal with levels of paranoia in covering politics that are astounding to me. People assume conspiracies. I mean, the conspiratorial sense of politics has moved closer towards the mainstream. Don't you see this happening?
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Yeah.
But the question is, what's the reason for that?
Right, and I would argue that it has something to do with, you know...
Okay, you can say there's something to do with the Iraq and the BMD, although, by the way, there have been 5 different inquiries in the UK, and whenever you come up with everyone acted in good faith, they just... I don't think that's the source of the conspiracy theories, and I don't think it's the source of the problem.
Okay.
Now, but you know, this is obviously an interesting debate, and one that, again, I think it's important for people like me to evaluate and reevaluate. I think conspiracy theories have got more and more close to the mainstream because what you've got is a fragmentation of the media, where the media becomes much more polarized today, left and right. Yep. People, therefore, don't have the same conversation.
Choose your own reality.
You choose your own reality, and social media then amplifies those conspiracy theories. So that's why I say social media is itself a revolutionary phenomenon. And one thing that gets really troubling to me is that some of these two conversations are going on with their own often conspiratorial view of the world, left and right. And that's what makes the center ground very difficult.
Well, that's interesting because you're redefining, because centrism isn't just a political concept, it's a comprehensibility concept. It's about the centralizing of information and consensus as opposed to just the centralization of a political.
So it's an attitude of mind.
Right.
It's an attitude of mind that says that I'm a Labour politician, but you know, I can see decent Tories with good ideas.
Right.
Now, you say that to parts of the Labour Party today, and they'd say, well, you're a traitor.
Right.
You get out of the room.
Right.
Now, and likewise on the right. So, you know, you can see this in the vehemence of some of the language used on left and right today. So the question is, you know, comes back to where we began. Can centrism recover its, you know, can it get its mojo back?
One of the things that really struck me in one of the transcripts of your conversations with Bill Clinton, I think it was in 97, 98. No, it was later than that. Where he said Bush wasn't prepared to be president. I thought that was just interesting because you were speaking fairly highly about his attributes. Do you think Clinton was right? Do you think Bush wasn't prepared to be president?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't actually recall that particular part of the conversation, but he'd gone through a long preparation as a governor and so on. I mean,
you don't remember that particular part of the thing. And then I guess the other question is in terms of the conversations that you have had with the Clintons over the years in terms of the turn in the politics. I'm just sort of fascinated by this notion of I had a conversation on my podcast with Bernie Sanders' campaign manager, and he said he was running against Bill Clinton. He wasn't running necessarily against Hillary. The Sanders people found Hillary in general to be flexible and palatable, but it was Bill Clinton that they were fundamentally running against.
This is very familiar to me. Yeah.
Do you think that is part of what is going on here? It is kind of the Empire Strikes Back when response, a backlash against New Labour and the New Democrat philosophy.
That is their thing. So Bill Clinton, surely one of the most successful American presidents in modern times. People forget on the left, you know, we fall for theories of betrayal very easily. And one of the things that's always depressed me about the left ever since I started in politics is their ability to imbibe the propaganda of the right and regurgitate it in a left-wing form. You know, we have the same issue here. Look, we were a government where we had 10 years of uninterrupted prosperity. We had massive reductions in poverty amongst pensioners, young people, every income group. We introduced the minimum wage. We started the Department for International Development, trebled aid, and it's probably one of the most radical innovations in development policy in the last 50 years. You know, we introduced a whole slew of things on human rights, civil rights, gay rights. We were a progressive government. We made big changes in education and healthcare that delivered better results for poorer people.
Vastly increased education and healthcare spending.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
But now you remember. But people, the left now is whacking you on Iraq. They You did the same stuff in terms of crime, the crime bill issues that Bill Clinton has said he regrets being so sort of strident in his anti-crime talk in the 1990s. Do you feel the same way, or do you think that was of the time?
You know, I think crime is a huge issue for people. If you're living in a poor estate and you've got drug dealers at the end of the street and your life's a misery and you're afraid of your kids going out the door, the job of progressive politicians is to do something about that. Now, I can't comment on the policies in the US, but the things that we did, which cut crime radically, you know, they were very popular in the very neighborhoods, by the way, that are then off supporting Brexit. So, you know, we shouldn't, these are important issues for people. The thing always is to go to where people really are and what they're really feeling about life. And then politics is about listening and it's about leading. You know, you've got to listen, but you've also got to lead. That's why, you know, when people on the left want to play around with the politics of immigration, there's people on the left here who say, yeah, now what we should be doing is having a more nationalist thing. We should be toying with Brexit, and that's the way of appealing to these people. No, it's not. You go in, you indulge that right-wing rhetoric. All you'll do is solidify them with the right. Instead, what you've got to do is you've got to listen to their concerns and deal with them in the right way. You know, you're going to be investing in those communities, changing their schools, making sure their kids get proper opportunities, helping them, but helping them always really going to help them. Not saying your problem is the guy who's from a different, you know, different color, a different face down the road.
Last question, and that is, do you think Brexit is actually going to happen? Do you think the Prime Minister has said, obviously we have the elections in Europe that are going to take place. She said that she will pursue it in 2017. Do you think Article 50 will ultimately be invoked? And do you think Brexit will actually happen?
I think this Conservative government believes that it can't contain the unity, can't retain the unity of the Conservative Party without delivering Brexit. But I think the country has got to take a view, and this debate will continue. You know, there's 48%, 60 million people that voted to remain, and we don't yet know what we're being offered. As I've always said to people, the bizarre thing about Brexit is it's like agreeing a house swap without having seen the other house. Right, so, okay, we agreed to do it. But now we're going to look at it. And we're going to see whether it's structurally sound. And we're going to see whether it's in the right type of neighborhood. And we're going to see what it might be like to live there. And, you know, I understand why there's parts of the right-wing media and the Conservative Party want to shut this debate down. But we're a free country. I don't think we should shut it down. I think we should keep analyzing and seeing what it is that we're going to be able to negotiate here.
Do you think it's appropriate and possible to have a second referendum when there's more meat on the bone, when there's more detail in the proposal?
I think at the moment we should rule nothing out. Why should we? You know, when people say you've got to rule it out, you've got to say no, there must be no more there must be no more discussion of this issue. Who made that rule?
So that's a maybe.
Let's make up our minds as we see what the facts are.
Thank you very much for your time.